Now you have a chance to ask questions or to make comments, or if you want to say anything, this is the opportunity. Fire away, as they say. See what happens. Does anyone have anything they want to bring up? So the question is this is all about compassion in Buddhism, and there's also about non-attachment, but the question is asking, isn't there a connection that sometimes when you are compassionate, there's also attachment in that connection with compassion? And I think the answer is that there is a large number of degrees of compassion. Yeah, there is compassion, more ordinary compassion that ordinary human beings have. You have compassion for your loved ones and for or whatever. And of course, in that situation, there is a degree of attachment. But you can also kind of walk past someone on the street, someone you have never seen before, you know, someone is sleeping rough or whatever, and you can have a sense of compassion for this person, but without really much attachment there, right? Because it's someone you never met, and you walk past and you forget about them 5 minutes later, but at that moment you had compassion for that person. And so the Buddhist idea is that, yes, sometimes there may be compassion, attachment coming with compassion, but as you develop your mind to a higher state, you let go of the attachment, but the compassion you actually develop further. And there comes a point when you kind of, the person in the street, you have enormous amount of compassion for that person without having an attachment. And then you kind of broaden that out to encompass the whole world. So it is possible to have enormous compassion without attachment. In fact, that is what the Buddha, in a sense, was. Yeah, he was a person who had an insight, and his main insight is about the suffering of the world. Yeah, the Four Noble Truths of the Buddha are phrased in terms of suffering, the cause of suffering, the end of suffering, and the path that leads to the end of the suffering. Yeah, so suffering is kind of one of the main insights of the Buddha. And of course, with that understanding of suffering, you also have an understanding of happiness, because it's the flip side of suffering. Yeah. And because you understand suffering, but as a generalized idea that all beings are afflicted by that, he also has compassion, yeah, because he knows the problem, and he knows he has a solution to the problem. So I think it's a matter of degrees and a matter of development. But for many people, I would agree with you that there will be a connection there very often between attachment and compassion, not really separated. So good point. So thank you. Thank you for that. Could I then say more about intention, lack of intention in meditation? My understanding of the Buddha's word in the Anapanasati Sutta was that intention played an important role part in the practice. This morning you seem to say that we ought to leave intention behind. Thank you. Okay, so intention is, there is some degree of intention there, because obviously if you leave all intention behind, then nothing is going to happen. You're not going to watch it. But the idea is that we tend to use too much willpower in meditation, and this is one of the big problems. And especially if you kind of come straight off the street, so to speak, and you go into a meditation center, and you have never really done any ethical conduct, you haven't practiced any kind of idea of compassion or kindness or anything like that. Then you're told, sit down and watch your breath. And then the only way that you're going to be able to do that, that any kind of clearing of the mind, directing of the mind, preparing the mind, but any kind of prior right view, any kind of prior ethical conduct, usually the only way, unless you are an unusual individual, is that you use willpower. And willpower often means grasping the breath. Yeah, and the way that will feel after a while, it will feel like a little bit tense. It will feel uncomfortable. You won't really be able to relax properly. So the idea in Buddhism is to combine relaxation and mindfulness. Yeah, that is kind of the idea. So I agree, there is a little bit of intention there, but it's almost like an automatic intention. It's because you're enjoying it. It's like, you know, if you are doing something you enjoy, how much intention is there in that? If you're watching a movie that you really enjoy, how much intention do you need to apply to watch that movie? Not that much, right? Or if you're seeing something very beautiful, you're seeing a beautiful sunset or something like that. How much intention do you need to apply to see that sunset? Well, because you're enjoying it, it's kind of, you're drawn towards it, and there's very little intention required. And ideally, you want the breath to be like that. The breath is so peaceful and calm, it is filled with joy because you have the right attitude, that you're drawn to the breath rather than having to kind of use a faculty of the mind or a purposeful intention to be able to follow the breath. Yeah, that is the ideal. And reality, of course, is more complex. But there is a tendency to use too much willpower in my, as far as I can tell, in meditation practice. I met some very good meditators in my life, and some of them, they say that, you know, even towards the very end, before you enter real stillness of the mind, they say, I realize I was using too much force. Yeah, you have lots of bliss, you have lots of really powerful stillness, and still the reason why you can't go all the way into deep samadhi is because you are using some kind of willpower there, which is holding on to the object rather than really releasing completely and really enjoying what is going on. Yeah, so something like that, I think, is the answer. Yeah. So the question is that during the meditation this afternoon, that I mentioned the idea of reflecting on someone you respect to bring some joy into the meditation. Isn't that taking you away from the meditation object? Yes, it is. And sometimes you have to do that temporarily, especially if you feel a big lack of energy. Yeah, you use something else to bring the energy back, and then you go back to the meditation object. But ideally, the ideal way of doing this is to just nudge the mind, yeah, not to actually reflect a lot. So let's say that you already have done this kind of contemplation in the past. Yeah, so you know what it feels like to pay respect to someone you really admire, or whatever. You know what the presence of that person means to you. But sometimes all you have to do is just very gently turn your mind in that direction. Remind yourself of the qualities of that person, and straight away the positive feelings come up. Yeah, like, for example, maybe one of the people that I like to kind of contemplate this about is actually the Buddha himself. Yeah, I have to do an imaginary contemplation of the Buddha and what it means, like you meeting the Buddha, being in his presence, and making something out of that. And sometimes I do that on retreats. I kind of give an idea of how to reflect like that. So then sometimes all I need to do is just to kind of remind myself of the Buddha. And it's like all of those feelings or emotions that come with that process of thinking come back because of that. So that is like nudging the mind. In the meantime, we need to do some contemplation to just get used to these ideas. And once you're used to the idea, then the nudging of the mind works in a sense. Can I clarify the Buddhist view on abortion? Thank you. Okay. Yeah, so these are, the Buddhist view on life is that, of course, taking life is considered a bad idea. Yeah, it's considered bad karma. But again, it's interesting. Is taking life always bad karma, or is it times when taking life is not bad karma? And to be able to understand this, you have to understand that in Buddhism, the final view of morality is not the five precepts. Yeah, it's not kind of the number of precepts that we have. But the number of precepts that we have is a guideline to morality. It's an approximation to morality that is very handy and very useful, so that you have a kind of quick guide. If you're about to kill someone, you stop yourself because you remember, okay, precept don't kill, right? Or something like that. Or you're about to lie or whatever else it is. But actually the final Buddhist view of morality is what you are motivated by, what drives your actions. So according to certain suttas, there are six basic kind of motivations in Buddhism called six roots or six, whatever. And they are greed, hatred, and delusion, or if you like, desire, ill will, and confusion. Yeah, these are kind of the three bad roots. Then you have the three opposite roots that are positive. Yeah, so it's like non-desire, yeah, or if you like, renunciation, non-ill will, or metta and compassion, and then non-confusion, which is kind of clarity of mind, or further down the track, even wisdom. So what is driving your action? Yeah, if you kill someone because you are greedy or because you're angry or whatever, obviously it's going to be a bad act. But let's say that you kill someone or you help them to die or whatever out of compassion, yeah, and wisdom. Take the case of euthanasia, voluntary assisted dying. If someone really wants to die, do we have the right to tell them, sorry, you can't die, I'm going to keep you alive regardless? And then maybe you think, hey, I'm going to keep you alive, I hate you, this is my chance, take revenge. That is the way you're making bad karma, right? Because you want to take revenge on them. I'm going to keep you alive. So sometimes keeping someone alive can be bad karma if you do it in the wrong way. That's kind of interesting, right? It turns things upside down a little bit. But if someone really has decided that they're going to die, and they are asking for a way out, and they want help for that, is it bad karma to help them? If you truly come in from compassion, if you truly have looked at the motives properly and you know where you're coming from, I would say no. It might even be good karma if you're coming from a good place. And I had myself a very interesting case a few years ago. It was a man who was a kind of close disciple and a close friend. And he asked me this question. He had some kind of neurological degenerative disease, and he was basically becoming completely paralyzed gradually over time. And he knew that when this disease came to a certain point, he wouldn't be able to do anything. He would just be lying in bed and kind of being able to breathe, basically. That was it. And so he asked me, yeah, what should I do? Is it okay if I go to Switzerland, to the famous Dignitas clinic in Switzerland, and kind of end it all? And as a monk, you have to be careful what you say at that point, because if you say, yeah, it's all right, you can do it, then you might no longer be a monk anymore, because you're not allowed to encourage anyone to kill themselves. But what you can say as a monk, you can talk about the karma of these things, yeah? What are the consequences? And so I told them this sort of thing I'm saying now, you know, if you do it with a clear mind, you know what you're doing, coming from the wholesome consequence, then it's not such a, you know, probably quite likely you would be fine because of that, but you're going to have to make the final decision yourself. I can't tell you what to do. And abortion is similar to this, yeah, because abortion is about, well, why do we do it? What is the situation? What is our motivation when we do these things? And the more you are coming from an understanding of wisdom and compassion when you do this, the less of a problem it is. If you kind of hate that fetus because it was very inconvenient, of course it's going to be a bad karma. But if you kind of balance all the things and you think, actually, I don't think this is probably going to be bad for everyone or all around, and then you do it on a balanced consideration, at least the karma is going to be much less bad, Whether it's really possible to eliminate the karma altogether, I'm not sure about, but certainly it will be less. So this is the one factor we should always look at in all our actions, and to decide the morality of any kind of situation. Where are we coming from? What is our motivation? And the more pure that motivation is, the less the bad karma is going to be. Then there's a second factor, and that is the development of the fetus. One of the kind of obvious things in Buddhism is that if something is not conscious, then there is no bad karma, because it cannot feel anything, it doesn't really exist yet as a being, so there cannot be any bad karma. So the question is, at what point does consciousness arise in a fetus? Does it arise straight away? Does it take some time? And I think this is one of those questions we don't really know exactly, to be honest. Some people say it arises at a certain stage, in the development of the fetus. Some people say it's straight away at conception that consciousness arises. But this, I think, is not entirely clear. And this is maybe an area where science maybe can answer those questions for us. But there seems to be at least some evidence, some kind of what you would call anecdotal evidence, so a bit uncertain, that consciousness actually arises quite a long time sometimes after conception. If that is the case, that also means that there is no bad karma because you're not actually killing any living being. Still, even if consciousness has arisen, the earlier you do it, the less the impact, right? Because it's almost like at the beginning, there's almost nothing there. It's like a tiny little thing, barely existing. So it really exists, depends on where you do it. Of course, if it is almost a fully grown baby ready to be born, then of course it is far, far worse because it is a much more kind of a serious thing when you do it at that point. So these are all the things that you have to take into account. And another aspect of all of this, which has to do with the idea of karma in general, people very often ask the question, is this action good karma or is it bad karma? And the answer very often is that actually, maybe it is neither good nor bad, it's somewhere in between. It's like gray karma, right? Because it is not the case that either our intention is terrible or it is really pure. Very often our intentions are somewhere in between. We're motivated by maybe a mixture of things, or maybe we are motivated by a very weak kind of desire or a very weak kind of compassion. And in those cases, it's not going to be neither very dark karma nor very bright karma, but somewhere in between. It's like a gray karma. So karma comes more on a gray scale rather than being either bad or good. It's a little bit bad, a little bit good, or maybe even neutral sometimes. And so what our job is as Buddhists is to kind of move to lighter shades of gray in kamma. Right? Most of the time, we cannot make entirely pure kamma because it's impossible. The only way you can make entirely pure and good kamma is after you come out of the deep state of samadhi, when there's no hindrances, your mind, your heart is completely pure. But how often is it that we come out of a state of samadhi? Not very often, right? It's not like every day or whatever. It's like all the time. It's quite rare. So because of that, most of the time, our minds are not actually that pure. They're somewhere in between. So our job is to add a bit more compassion to our actions, add a bit more loving kindness, add a bit more wisdom. And as we do that, we're moving up the scale and we're making a kind of the grayness is getting less and less gray, right? Lighter and lighter shades of gray. That is when we kind of are on the right track. And this is, I think, the right way of thinking about kamma. In the suttas, the world talks about four kinds of kamma: dark kamma with dark results, the bright kamma with bright results, dark and bright kamma with dark and bright results. This is kind of the grayscale kamma. And then you have neither dark nor bright kamma with neither dark nor bright results, which is all about the kind of awakening kamma, which leads out of a samsaric existence. That's a long answer for you on abortion. There was very little about abortion there, a lot about many other things, but I hope you're okay with that. Thank you, Ajahn, for your insightful and helpful teachings. Question: in deep stillness or jhana, when the will has gone and left still with no five sense awareness, how long does one remain in that state? And when does one emerge from that state, please? Also, in this state, is one like frozen and cannot move? Okay, so it depends. Yeah, these states can usually, they will last quite long because they are powerful states. And it is very unlikely to last very, very, like, you know, a short time. Usually they last for hours, these kind of states. So if it is a real jhana, it is kind of, you're stuck there for quite a while. Now, sometimes people have like a bounce, they almost enter jhana, but not quite. So they kind of bounce into it and out again. But because of maybe a kind of a bit of fear or whatever, you come out very quickly. But it will either be a bounce or it will last quite long, but it won't be a short one. Is it like frozen? Yes, it's basically like frozen because you cannot will anything. And if you cannot will anything, it means that there's nothing you can do. Yeah, you cannot will, you cannot even will to will. So you are basically stuck in that state. So that is the jhana states. All right, let's go. I'll go on to the next one. I'll just go to scroll down a bit. I know how to do that. That's good. Okay, I have a question about dealing with doubt. During meditation, I find it difficult to decide on things like which position to meditate in or whether to keep my eyes closed or open. And I often find I'm using my willpower to try and stop myself changing my mind. How can I move beyond that? So first of all, just decide on a posture. The best posture is a posture where you can relax. Yeah, you can leave the body aside for as long as possible. Don't worry too much about posture, whether you sit on a chair. If you have a chair, get a useful chair. Yeah, some chairs are more suited for meditation. It should have kind of four legs. Don't have a chair with wheels on it, yeah, for example, because you're going to start wheeling around. And that's kind of going to be bad for the meditation experience. With a kind of nice and straight back, yeah, and you can kind of relax. The most important thing is that we can relax and leave the body to one side. That is what really matters. Sit on the floor, you can lean against the wall, you can have a bench, you can use as many cushions as you like. You can even lie down. Yeah, for some people, lying down actually works. It depends on whether you feel quite clear or not. If your mind is quite clear, lying down may actually be very, very useful because you can, at least you can relax properly when you lie down. There's only one meditation posture that is not recommended, and that is standing on your head. Yeah, because if you stand on your head, and if we're going to, and actually there's a monk who did this, and so this is not a joke. Yeah, this is actually dead serious. And he's standing on his head, and he went into a bit of samadhi because he was really enjoying a yoga posture or something. And then when he came out of that samadhi, he found himself in a big pile on the floor, kind of feet and legs and arms kind of intertwined. And he didn't know how to kind of had a hard time getting out of that new posture, which was barely considered. So standing on your head is not recommended. Yeah, from not personal, but from experience. So just take one posture and then decide on that, and then forget about posture. And keep eyes closed. Yeah, this is kind of keeping eyes open. I wouldn't recommend that for meditation, because there's so much information coming in through the eyes that if you allow that, there's no chance. You will get very still with your eyes open. So I would definitely recommend keeping eyes closed, unless you find it uncomfortable. There are people who don't enjoy meditation, find it actually very hard and very kind of almost traumatic to meditate. And if you find that, then try something else. Maybe eyes open, or maybe don't meditate at all, or whatever it might be. It's not supposed to be traumatic to meditate. It's supposed to be enjoyable. Otherwise, it's kind of no point whatsoever. So just decide, and then just let it be, because that's kind of the whole purpose of this. I don't know if much more to be said about that. How do you overcome meditation being torturous? I get very restless and agitated and look forward to the end. Do you have an advice on how to start to enjoy it? Thank you. That's very honest, isn't it? I like that. Thank you for being so honest. Yes, I think you are not the only one in the world who thinks like that. I think this happens to many people, especially if you're sitting in a group and you can't get up, right? And you kind of, otherwise you're going to, other ones are going to be disturbed. Oh no, I have to sit for another 20 minutes. Oh no, I can't stand it any longer. And you have to sit there. And this happens sometimes with people. And so what you have to do is to sit shorter times. Yeah, don't do things that are beyond your reach. Lower your standards to the absolute minimum. So sit for 5 minutes or 10 minutes, yeah? No more than that. And usually most people can do 5 or 10 minutes. Sit at a time that is good for you. Choose a good time, yeah? Early in the morning, you get up. I don't know how you feel early in the morning. Don't check your mobile phone first, yeah? No, first of all, get up. If you feel good, you can meditate straight away. Or have a cup of tea, or if you're not English, have a cup of coffee, or whatever is your fancy. Actually, not these days. The English are really declining. They used to drink tea, or now they drink coffee. So many English people. I'm surprised things are changing in this country. Surprise, surprise, things are changing. And do a little bit to get your mind cleared out early in the morning, and then that can be a good time to meditate for me. So find a good time, make it short, yeah? Make it something you can do easily. Have a nice spot where you can meditate. Use a guided meditation to get you in the right mood, yeah? There are people who do beautiful guided meditations, and if you find a beautiful one that really puts you in the right mood, listen to that, because it's quite hard sometimes on your own to get in the right mood for meditation, yeah? And then build up the right things in this way. Don't come back from work and be really stressed out and agitated and go and sit down meditation straight away. That's the worst thing. You should never do that. At the very least, take a bit of time. Allow yourself to find a bit of peace of mind. Listen to some peaceful music. Again, have a cup of tea or something. Walk about a little bit, read something nice, whatever, right? And then gradually make your mind ready for these things. And then you become less agitated and restless, hopefully, as a consequence. So just gently, yeah? And be kind to that. And if you can't meditate at all, that's fine. Much more important than meditation is actually how you live. Make sure you are kind. Make sure you are a good person. Make sure you learn to use your mind in such a way that you have compassion and kindness for everyone in the world, right? That is actually the most important thing. And if you keep on doing that consistently for longer periods of time, yeah, months on end, years on end, then guaranteed meditation will eventually work for you, because this is the cause of meditation itself. Okay, does anyone else want to say anything here? No? Okay, you're so content. Yeah, that's wonderful. So we are happy to have contented participants. Any questions about contentment? No, okay. Okay, good.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org. buddhism.org/donate.